South County Historical Society had the exhibit when they did. And so the goal might be is these interviews, archive them. But then if we wanted to take it a step further and make an actual documentary, we may come back with you too and shoot another interview on a high definition camera. And then what we might do with that is submit it to like film festivals and stuff like that. So we just want to make it an educational, but also something that might be, you know, played on the History Channel or just, you know, local film festivals, San Francisco, LA, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo. So it's just crucial. You guys see the importance of it. Mm-hmm. Though. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, because from his small farm in Lower Arroyo, then we enlarged it to Upper Arroyo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, it's all fascinating, and you know, most of the people that live here I would venture to guess that they don't know the history here. So that's the goal, is just to, because in school we didn't really get taught it, at least I didn't in high school level, and we're right here in Arroyo Grande where it all happened. You know, so it's very important
because I'm hearing it.
Okay, guys.
All right, we're ready to go. Okay, so we were talking about. Transfer from Gila or from Tulare to Gila,
yeah.
And what kind of experience it was, or what I'm curious to know is, you and your brothers went to Gila while your mom was the one that decided to stay with your father.
Yeah,
to Fresno.
Because he went, they had to move the hospital patient to Fresno. Assembly Center, because Gila Hospital wasn't ready, it wasn't built yet. So everybody that was hospitalized in Tulare, or maybe the other Assembly Center too, they moved them to Fresno because I guess that facility was. Probably larger, and probably had better doctors, you know, assembled over there.
Uh-huh.
So, first, when you moved to, went to Gila, our family was put in a different block than all the friends that went in from around here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were wondering why they put us in a certain place. they said, well, your dad's be moved over here, so this block is closer to the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So you could, you know, go back and forth to the hospital.
Oh, okay.
But we, after we went to Gila, I don't know how long my dad stayed in the hospital, but we decided to, we asked the hospital doctors, can we bring him to our home barrack and take care of him?
Mm-hmm.
He was paralyzed and he took a lot of
care.
Mm-hmm. So there was four of us. We kind of took turn
watching it.
Yeah.
So how long was it before because I know your brothers went back east or Midwest. How long was it how long were you guys together before everyone started to leave, to take off?
Well, my youngest brother was a UC Berkeley student.
He went to Ohio, didn't he?
No, was a Berkeley student. So the first so many months, you know, Gila Camp school was looking for teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So he applied to teach over there, anybody that had any kind of a college education there, they use them. And then when they start opening up, trying to get the young people to go back east, wherever they want to go, they allow them. If you're a student, they could find a college to go. They allow them to go.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to Toledo, see.
Mm-hmm.
So they left my brother and I and mother to take care of that. Then when dad passed away, then my other brother went to Toledo too. See. He worked over there. But
and then you finally left to go work as well.
Yeah.
After your father had passed away.
Yeah.
And
being in the camp, it was all Japanese, you know. Mother, you know, she took care of herself.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have any problems. So.
Yeah. So you figured that you would be okay for you to go off. When you left and you went and you worked in Idaho and you worked in Chicago, and then you went to Utah eventually, did you ever feel any hostility towards you by anyone in those areas?
No.
So how do you feel was the situation better or worse the farther east you got when it came to?
I think it was a lot better back east, but they, you know, after he came back here again,
mm-hmm.
and met some new people, you know, a lot of people started moving in here, you know. Most of them didn't even know evacuation took place.
Oh, really? So they're just kind of oblivious to what was going on.
Yeah.
I remember when we first met, you told us the story of you being your deferment for the army and the draft.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to have you tell that again of what happened with you going to Chicago and losing your status as a deferment and then coming to Utah, and what kind of involvement you think you suspect that Vard Loomis might have had in all of that with him being on the draft board.
I think everybody who went into camp was on the 4F or whatever you call it, classification that, you know, military didn't touch you, see,
uh-huh.
as long as you. But the minute you went out, you had to make a change of address.
Uh-huh.
They want you to, as soon as you got there, you had to put in a change of address to the draft board.
Uh-huh.
As soon as you did that, you automatically was reclassified to 1A.
Mm-hmm. And so.
So when I, in Chicago, as soon as they reclassified me 1A, they called me in for physical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was 25, 6 years old and in good health, never had any problems, so passed his flying colors.
Yeah.
So, mother, being by herself, being the firstborn,
mm-hmm.
the head of the family, she didn't want me to go in the service, you know, and just begged me to stay off.
She didn't speak English.
So she didn't want to be left alone.
Yeah. So she probably wrote to friends, said, can't you, you know, find him a job for him. So I went from Chicago, left Chicago, and went to Utah when a close friend was farming. Mm-hmm. Over there, I was 1A anyway. But they wrote the draft board, the family wrote the draft board saying, you know, I guess they wanted them to defer me because I was so valuable mm-hmm. on the farm.
On the farm.
Or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I didn't write anything, but they did. So, the draft board, you know, changed my classification back to 3A again. That you know, deferred me for occupation reason.
Mm-hmm.
But probably then that was. It was only a few weeks or so before I had a notice to report to the military service in Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm. And then?
Then the deferment came.
Uh-huh. So you didn't have to worry about it. That's interesting that how that all worked out. I guess I might as well touch on right now the relationship that you had as an individual and then your family had with the Loomises and how you guys became such good family friends.
Well, first of all, we're all farmers.
Uh-huh.
And Loomis's family business was supply house that sold the hay to the farmers. Okay. First of all, they sold a lot of hays because in those days it was team horses. Every farmer had horses.
Horses, yeah.
So they sold us hay. They sold us fertilizer. They sold us seed, insecticide, everything.
Uh-huh.
And you know they trusted the Japanese, so you didn't have to pay cash. He was, you know, you paid them at the end of the season, or maybe monthly, or every once in a while you get a little behind. They had one of the brothers, Loomis brothers, would come around and says, "You think you could pay me so much?"
So just as it came, became necessary, yeah, I guess. Yeah. That's interesting.
So, yeah, so we knew Loomis's had the oldest son was Ivan, next one was Buster, and Bard. Three sons were here, but they had other brothers that...
John.
No, not... they were, I mean, he was, he went into other business, I guess,
mm-hmm.
you know. But we knew them real well because, especially Vard, he graduated Stanford in 1931,
uh-huh.
And he came back to the farm, I mean, to his family business. And he was younger, so I guess they sent him out to see all the farmers, you know, and visited them to ask them, is there anything you need or whatever.
Mm-hmm. See?
And he got real friendly with a lot of people, like my dad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they would sit down out in the middle of the field for an hour talking about probably baseball. Or
because Bard was a player. He played baseball at Stanford.
He played baseball at Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1932, year after he came back, my dad started realizing that we nieces need something besides just work.
Needed an outlet.
Should have some recreation. And he loved baseball, so he asked Ward, would you coach the Japanese boys, you know, since you play baseball, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he agreed. And he coached us for 10 straight years.
Oh, wow.
Wherever we traveled, his wife would go along. You know?
So he kind of became your guys'.
So he was our, you know, your mentor or whatever you want to call him.
Yeah, almost like a role model for you guys as younger kids.
Yeah.
And so what kind of effect did, I mean, you have him as being this outlet for you guys to be able to play baseball as a kids, and then during...
Well, in fact, he even coached the basketball during the winter.
Oh, wow. So he had a large part in your guys' recreational outlets. And then obviously during the war, you stayed with him while you and your father were still in the area, and then he kept the farm
when we had to leave, I asked the Lord, can you, manage the farm for us? So he got a couple of fellows to farm the place.
Mm-hmm.
He collected rent, paid the taxes. So, and he did that for some other Japanese family too, I think.
Yeah. What I think, I think it's really admirable of him to do what he did, but what do you think motivated him to, because obviously it wasn't something that didn't put him out any. I mean, he had to, probably was a lot of work to be able to, keep things,
I think a lot of the Japanese did business with them.
Uh-huh.
Japanese is practically all the business, farmers did business with Loon's families.
Uh-huh.
And he knew that, Japanese were reliable, they didn't have to worry. They all probably got paid, In fact, I heard that some of the farmers owed these butcher or some of these other merchants, but when they all came back, every one of them got paid, none of them just left and forgot them.
They made sure that
Japanese were known for paying their bills.
Uh huh.
Of course, if you went broke, I guess you can. Some couldn't be helped, but
so obviously he felt a responsibility to uphold the same respect that they had shown towards him. And what did that, I mean, it might be kind of an obvious question, but what did that mean to you, your family, and you, that he was willing and able to uphold the farm and uphold the property as he did?
Well, we were so close, In fact, he was closer to probably Japanese than a lot of the Caucasians, because
he was so involved.
Yeah,
he
was so involved in everything. He was such a nice man, mm-hmm. reliable fellow that all over the county, he was well known,
mm-hmm. well liked.
And for good reason, I think.
Yeah.
What do you think that he had any, this is all speculation, but do you think he had any difficulties with with just being so involved with, discrimination or hard feeling toward him being so involved and helpful
during the war, when some people found out he was boarding me,
Uh-huh.
this place. Some other people went to the office, their main office over there,
mm-hmm.
and told him. He said, I guess they gave him a bad time, saying, how come you're boarding the Jap when the war with Japan and all that?
Uh-huh.
And
he was a Jap lover.
Yeah.
Do you, I mean.
But I never, after everybody left, I stayed just around here. I didn't make friend and talk to many outsiders because I wasn't supposed to be
uh-huh.
around anyway.
Yeah. So you just had no way of knowing that, and I'm yeah. sure that it was probably a challenging time for him.
But Bard would, after we came back, Bard never mentioned to me the hard time he got from some of these other people, you know.
Yeah.
I heard it through the grapevine.
That things like that.
Thing, yeah.
That's, I don't know. Okay.
But there were a few other farmers, like there's a Phelan, Cyril Phelan,
mm-hmm.
Ed Taylor. He used to be a deliver gasoline and all that. Even I guess during the war he started farming. And Gus Phelan didn't do much farming in the valley, but I guess he was farming all over. But he probably took over some of the farms. And after we came back, they were our neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't have the equipment that was necessary to do all the farming. So once in a while, we'd ask them, can we borrow your this or that? And he says, oh, go ahead. And they're all real nice.
So
except there was one family that they had youngsters. They were younger than I, but I guess they were deferred because they were farming.
Uh-huh.
And, they acted like they didn't like us,
Oh, wow.
But we could tell they were farming right next door. Next, Hayashi's in the farming this side, and he was farming the land we used to lease and farm,
Oh, okay.
And we hardly talked to them because they kind of ignored us.
Oh, wow.
But we watched them farm, and
some prejudice.
We could tell.
Definitely.
We could tell they were in produce. Vegetable farmers, by the way they were farming. The Japanese farming on this side had beautiful crops, and he's got on this side, he had a terrible crop. Well, he didn't last very long because
mm-hmm. he didn't know what he was doing.
No.
And so, I mean, that's what I was going to hit upon next, was just, coming back and what kind of effect it had, being gone and the entire camp experience, what kind of effect that had on trying to resettle back into the farming life. And obviously it seems like that you had quite a bit of, it really wasn't as difficult as it could have been, but it didn't go, it wasn't without some prejudice.
So some prejudice, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that, or how would you assess?
See, I didn't come back till November or December, mm-hmm. until the crop was out in Utah, which,
uh-huh.
In the winter months, it's completely gone. So I came back with my uncle,
uh-huh.
Hayashi's In fact, they were over there working too, and I drove their truck with all the household goods. Uh-huh. Yeah. Hi. Yeah, so I drove a truck from, you know, bobtail truck from Utah back to Oregon for them. Came to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
Las Vegas Boulevard was one
strip.
There was no strip there.
Not quite yet.
No.
Just a little town in the middle of the desert, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't know it was a, you know.
Hadn't quite made it yet.
No.
That's funny. Did you have any challenges in involved with trying to reestablish farming and then getting back into POVI, reestablishing POVI and things of that sort? Was there was it that difficulty trying in the business aspect?
Well, POVI leased out to rented out to a couple of Filipino farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Salvador Reyes and Gabe De Leon, you know. But when he came back and we started farming, they returned back in shed area, Povey area.
Uh-huh. So they just handed it back over to you guys when you came back?
Came back and started, you know.
And you just jumped right back into it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, was it kind of, you know, just hit the ground running type of a thing, or were you did you guys kind of have to build yourselves back up, back into getting the business running again?
Well, they were, you know, those stuff. A lot of the farm in the valley was probably run by Filipino farmers, I guess. So they knew that soon as we came back that they had to return this.
Right.
So
yeah,
gradually they returned the place.
And then, did you have to kind of evolve the, you know, the kind of crops that you had to grow and the way you ran the business after you came back? Was there kind of a shift that you had to make prior to, or compared to before you were put in the camps?
Well, we still started growing the same type of crop, like lettuce and celery and broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
Cauliflower, you know.
It just kind of went with the shifts and
the
way it worked. Interesting.
Instead of being able to farm whole 60 acres we owned over there, I farmed maybe, when it started out, was maybe 25% of the farm, because, you know, trying to do all by yourself and limited finance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then, so we, in fact, I leased a portion of the farm to some other nieces that came back, and they didn't have no place to really farm, so they say, how about leasing me part of your land? I said, okay.
Mm-hmm. Like you said earlier, you weren't able to use all of it at the time.
No.
So that worked out well for you guys as well. Well, I also wanted to talk about, you know, you've now got the fourth generation of your family involved with Bryson, and I'm just curious as to, and this is kind of an open-ended question for the both of you too, how does that make you feel to have, you know, another generation finally coming into the family business?
Well,
it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful, yeah. It's,
to keep the farm up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he's really interested in farming, so, you know, we give him all the technical stuff, like, you know, farming in more, it's harder because they got so many regulations, you know, and they want you to have everything written down and computers, and we don't even know how to use computers. You know?
So that's, it's all beyond you.
Beyond you
at this point. What kind of future do you see for POVI when you see, you know, the next generation coming into it?
Well, see, POVI pre-war had maybe 40, 50 farmers, you know. They all were small farmers, but they started, a lot of the people in Pismo area never came back because most of them were dry farmers. You used to get a lot of rain, they grew nice bush pea and stuff, but they didn't come back. In this valley, a lot of them weren't able to come back because they were all leased land, so they couldn't get the farm again.
So they lost out.
So we're down to 5 farmers now.
Wow.
You know, but they're all, big acreage compared to old days.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so it's, but it's pretty, I don't know how they're getting along. I hope they're all getting along. They grew up together, you know.
So, I guess, would you, do you think that it's going to change a lot now that you've got Bryson and the younger generation coming into it? Or, I mean, would you like to see it change? Or what kind of future do you see for POVI?
Well, I don't think you're going to change too much because, you know, this area is known for the climate. And it's got a mild climate year round. So you could grow just so much different crops, like, you know, lettuce family, cauliflower, broccoli, but it's getting tougher and tougher because, you know, you got some, you know, Salinas or San Ramon Valley. These farmers are, you know, got thousands of acres. You know,
these huge farms.
Yeah, you know, like Bolivia, Bonita farm, and Teixeira's and Maldonado's, I don't know how they get so big right away, but huge. But it's changing over there too, because you go over there the last couple of years, the acreage of strawberry growing over there is maybe 50%. Have you been to San Ramon Valley just recently? God, you know, the plastic, it's all over the place.
Oh, really? Yeah.
That's all strawberries.
In fact, I was thinking, well, that, in a way, that's good for us because that means there's that much less
competition.
Lettuce or other vegetable crop. You know? But I don't know.
But that could be a trend where it could, you know, leak over to you guys more often, too. I think, you know, there's a certain cultural aspect to all of this that we haven't really talked about, and I just wanted to know what kind of role the family takes from, you know, pre-war, war, to even now, and kind of how traditions and the kind of assimilation that Japanese culture has with American culture over the years. I just want to get your guys's, how you've seen that change with within the recent decades, especially with, you know, the effects of the war and things of that sort.
The Japanese here, they haven't really met much prejudice, you know, like some other communities.
Yeah.
I noticed that.
And so do you think that's kind of a unique aspect to this area?
I think so. It's really nice.
Uh-huh.
Everybody got along.
Yeah.
Because I worked in Illinois, and they had never seen a Japanese, you know, and they thought, oh, the Japanese were, you know, horn-rimmed glasses, and that's how they picture
me. Yeah, they're their stereotypical
picture
in the head.
Yeah, when they met me, they were surprised that I looked nothing like that.
And so was it, because you were in Chicago, right?
I worked in Chicago. Well, I evacuated from my relocation camp to Chicago.
To Chicago. Okay, so after the war, after the camp, you went to Chicago and made it back out here.
I didn't have anything in California.
But I'm just interested when you mentioned that they had a mental picture in their head. Was that kind of something where they had, it was a prejudice picture that they had in their head, or just kind of something that had been shown to them?
No, they had never seen a Japanese.
Because
I evacuated from camp to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to work in suburbs of Chicago, Evanston.
Oh, okay.
And they had never seen a Japanese. And they just pictured Japanese as horn-rimmed glasses, and
And so was that? Did you meet with just kind of like, oh, I guess this is.
Well, then they look at me, and say, oh, you're no different than us.
Yeah. And so just kind of broke their image that they had.
Uh-huh, right.
That's interesting. Did you ever meet with any kind of
prejudice?
Yeah.
No, not really.
It was kind of.
Yeah, people were nice. I mean, everyone I met.
What kind of. Did you guys feel as though you need to feel or act American or keep yourself kind of secluded?
I never felt prejudice, I guess that's why.
Yeah, and so. Did you kind of feel as though when you were reestablished and you were in Chicago or you came back to AG, just kind of life as normal kind of a feeling?
Well, I didn't live here before, so. Uh-huh.
But I mean, did you ever feel that you had to kind of act a certain way or keep yourself?
Did you? I didn't.
Well, we just try to be, you know, normal and up and up on everything you do, be friendly. So, you know, they think people in Oregon, you know, Caucasian people that we meet, they think we're all good people, nice people, you know. My son Bard is married to
beautiful blonde.
Okay, Terry, Terry Lee, and we meet a lot more Caucasian people through them too, and we all Japanese Niseis all try to help whatever they had in the community, like Boy Scout fundraisers in early days. When they have fundraisers, they have a light breakfast and they pass out the name cards of a lot of people in the valley. Well, these Caucasian friends that were helping out for the fundraising, they all wanted to grab the Japanese family's name to go ask for donation.
Yeah, because they were generous.
Japanese people were generous, and they probably nobody turned them down. See?
Uh-huh.
You know, so
they knew they knew that you guys were
willing to
help
out.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, obviously that creates a good reputation for.
So even the basketball organization, uh-huh. they have a youth kids basketball program.
My
two sons practically ran that program.
Uh-huh.
And now they're helping out the coach in high school
team.
But, you know, they're not teachers that, you know, get paid for whatever they do, but everything is volunteers.
Volunteer, yeah.
Of course, I guess being a basketball head coach in a high school, they get little pay because, you know, they have to travel and stuff. So
yeah,
but, you know, it's not a full time job.
Yeah,
all these sanseis are supporting the program. Be it baseball or basketball, or, you know, soccer league or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when it comes to fundraising and stuff, we try to pitch in as much as possible.
Yeah. So just doing as much as you possibly can.
Yeah,
we're
trying to do probably more than normal.
Uh-huh. Is that
lucky that we could afford to do that?
Uh huh.
Right now.
Yeah.
In the future, I don't know. You can't tell, but you know.
But when you can, you try and give what you can.
And it's good to have a youth program.
Yeah.
You know, keep the young people active and doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And that seems like that's always been an aspect that's been around for when you were young, and you know, you always had, like with Bart Loomis, always kind of giving you guys that outlet.
Yeah.
And it seems like you guys, it's very a very important aspect to the lifestyle of the community, and in order to be able to continue that and give that back.
He's been active in, you know, youth activities,
uh-huh.
and now our sons are
you
know, doing it, so it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Some of the people I met after the war, you know, in our business and whatever,
mm-hmm.
maybe they came from Midwest. You know, and they didn't even know Japanese during the war, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, what we went through.
Yeah.
The evacuation. Most of them never knew.
That
just the West Coast people knew that we had to. They, a lot of them just probably wanted to shove us out of here, but that was probably due to competition, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of prejudice in the early days.
Yeah.
Well, they were farming, they wanted to buy land, and they put in an alien land law where
you couldn't own land.
Yeah. But people in the Midwest, they didn't know.
Yeah.
A lot of them didn't know. Maybe a few of them did, but friends I met, they moved to California after the war. They had no idea.
That's interesting because it's, well, I mean, obviously for us as students, we're, you know, exposed to that. And it's just interesting to think, you know, wow, there are some people that don't.
Well, even our own children didn't know that we had to evacuate. And just, you mean they kicked you out of here? You know?
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I'm interested in knowing is, what kind of exposure did you give? Were you willing to tell them about it? But was it?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, was it something that you kind of?
nothing to hide, actually. Uh-huh. We just told them our experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're not all that interested in knowing what we went through.
That's also something, I'll ask you is, where has the greatest interest in your guys' background come from on a generational standpoint?
What do you mean?
Is it, like you said, your children don't seem to be as interested, but for me, as like my grandparents, I'm interested in hearing about their experiences.
Are you third or fourth generation?
I am I'm Yonsei.
Yonsei.
Yeah, and so have you received, where do you see the most interest coming from in the younger generations?
The difference?
Or like...
Like our children don't feel any different, huh? Mm-hmm. They just assimilate with everybody. And,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and they don't, I don't think they've met much prejudice.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's interesting. That's kind of almost become a non-issue.
Uh-huh. Especially in this community.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you went to a bigger city, you know,
uh-huh.
how that would be.
Yeah, affect you.
Do we have Augusto Molino?
Augustine Molino?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He works for the Kidd Brothers. How long has he been employed?
I don't know, maybe five, 6 years, I'm not sure.
Oh, the secretary is not here, and we really don't know. He might have been here 5, 6 years. Augustine?
Tell him to call back later, we're busy.
And what did you want to know about him?
Mitchy, tell him to call back later.
What's your last name?
How's your mom doing?
She's doing good.
Is she babysitter most of the time?
Well, you know, about 2 or 3 times a week, she'll take the morning shift for my sister. She'll take care of her 2-year-old granddaughter.
Yeah.
And then Brody, who's going to be, he's going to turn 5 here in a couple of weeks. He's
5?
Yeah,
oh, really?
Can you believe that? I know. Time flies.
Yeah.
He's just growing like crazy. Yeah, he... he goes to school Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So he's pretty much, my dad, I think, picks him up a lot during the afternoon, and they'll go get ice cream and go to the park a lot. So, yeah, so everybody's doing good.
Yeah,
everybody's doing really good.
What was this interview for?
This is for Cal Poly in the Ethnic Studies Department. is they're creating a South County Japanese internment oral history.
Oh, yeah.
Mainly based around the farmers in the area.
Are you interviewing other people also?
Yeah, actually there's probably, was there probably 20 of us in the class?
Yeah.
There's probably a total of 20 of us in the class, and then we've been paired off, and we've all been talking
to them separate. No, I meant, are you interviewing other people in this area?
Yeah. Everyone that we're interviewing is from the Arroyo Grande area.
Oh, I
yeah.
see.
Yeah. That's
our Fukuhara.
Yeah, the Fukuharas, the
Kubaras.
The Kubaras.
Oh.
We interviewed Bryson. and
so. How about Doys?
We did not get a hold of any of the Doys, or have not. But they're hoping to be able to just continue getting as many interviews as possible. So.
How many POVI members?
There's only five.
Five? Oh.
Yeah. Doys. Solitaries.
Guys like Ben and Aki. Hopefully we'll be approached to do it as well.
Yeah.
Maybe even Leroy.
Maybe Kira Hayashi Salatari.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I want to talk about a couple more things before we wrap things up. I wanted to talk to you about religion, actually, and the role it's played for you, because I know that your family were Christian.
Yeah.
When traditionally Japanese Americans, most of them are actually Buddhist.
Yeah.
So I just want to know how that's had an effect, a differing effect on your experiences with the community.
See, my dad became a Christian, I don't know when, but when we moved into Oregon Valley, he said, I'm Christian, so we should go to Christian. So we started going to Methodist church, Sunday school. You know.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was being oldest. As I was able to drive, I used to pick up a few of our friends.
Mm-hmm.
The boys in the family would tag along with me to go to the Christian Methodist church, and the girls in the family went to Buddhist. But I'm so-called Methodist Christian, but I'm not one of those real tightened, you know.
Yeah.
One that attend church.
So it probably didn't have as much of an effect on your everyday life as as some.
Well, your dad became a Christian because he worked for this family.
What
he told me.
Oh, I don't know.
That's what he told me.
I've
always been a Christian, though.
Oh, really? So did you ever have, was there any ever difference because you were, you know,
a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
No, I was always friends with Buddhists. You know, the Japanese were either Buddhist or Christian.
Yeah, exactly.
And very few Catholics.
Uh-huh.
I've had friends in all the religions.
Yeah.
And didn't make any difference.
Yeah.
No. All over California, they had the Japanese associations.
Yeah.
Each county, like San Luis Obispo County, Japanese Association, and they all got together maybe 2-3 times a year.
Yeah.
There's functions, you know. And of course, they had Japanese school all over, too. Plus, when you came to sports, they had all these Japanese baseball team. You know, every town or, you know, community down, up and down the coast, all the way up to state of Washington, there are a lot of Japanese teams.
Yeah.
Even from the youngster, like 10-year-olds, you know.
Oh, wow, they had several different.
Yeah, if they had a lot of enough people, kids, they formed a team, and they play the next, like Guadalupe or San Luis. San Luis had one, Oregon had one, Sarmiento had one, Guadalupe had a couple, and Lompoc and Santa Barbara, and all up and down the coast, all the way up to state of Washington. You know, they used to, Washington, some of these teams used to come all the way down this way to play games.
Oh, wow. So you're able to get quite a bit of, interact with quite a few.
Yeah, we didn't go that far up, but we went as far as Stockton, Alameda, Salinas, and Monterey,
Which is, quite a bit of, interaction for being able to just, just playing baseball. You're able to meet up with quite a few people.
So, Japanese kids were playing ball since that age. So, in high school days, like Oregon Grande, high school was made up of maybe 60% Japanese, Niseis, but bigger cities, because the Caucasian young white kids, they didn't have those summer programs for the kids.
Yeah, so they had to be able to,
But in for Japanese Issei's parents, that was their outlet to watch the games. Every Sunday they look forward to watching it. Whole families come home.
It was an experience for everyone. Being able to have that, and so that's a big part of the community. Being able to have that, that for everyone to enjoy.
But as after the war, we didn't have enough Japanese kids around, so we, started joining. Probably it was after the war that they started forming Little League and, for the kids to play. After Little League, they didn't have any more team after that.
Exactly.
So about four or five of us, got together and said, let's form a Babe Ruth age group.
So I remember you telling us you were able to get sponsors and several teams together to be able to get an older league started.
Areas getting so populated, and they got so many new people moving in. They got Little League and Babe Ruth League, and now they don't want Babe Ruth League. They want Cal Ripken League. They start fighting among themselves. I said to myself, good thing I'm not even getting involved nowadays.
That'd be too much then, huh? that's really neat though that it's able, that's kind of taken off and continued to go on like today as it does. Well, I wanted to ask you guys one final kind of question. And how do you, with all of this, experience that you had with internment and then resettlement and the years of in the 1980s when they had the formal apology by the government and they were giving these $20,000 redress payments to the survivors of the internment, I want to know, how do you guys feel about that? About the entire situation, how do you feel? What are your feelings behind what happened?
Well, that $20,000 that we received.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
probably wasn't enough for some.
I donated most of them
mm-hmm.
to various organizations.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that, you know, you have to have it. Well, probably the main thing is that when you came back, we started doing expanding, and we were doing pretty well, so I figured there's other people, places that they use that money, so I donate that, most of that money back to, you know, community or whatever. I can't remember when I gave it to, but, you know, when they started getting the signature to see, you know, to push for that.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of people, well, I know because of that evacuation, you know, we got set back, you know, to get back into farming again, and lost a lot of opportunity. But we're doing well enough that I need all that government money.
Yeah, exactly. Do you feel that it was necessary in order to have that given to you, or you say that you're doing well enough that you didn't feel it was.
I'm pretty sure for some people,
it really was.
They lost a lot.
Uh-huh.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess you, especially with, you know, with your farm, and being able to come back to what you had, was actually a very fortunate situation.
Yeah, there are farmers in some areas that they bought the land, they had the land bought, but they almost had to give it away, and because they didn't want them back there.
Yeah, exactly.
So for them, you know, they were probably glad to get, took that money, you know.
Exactly, yeah. Just be able to take it off their hands. Is it, when you look back on that time period and those experiences, is it something that you are very, I don't know, for some people it might be very emotionally charged, or I know that some people, depending on their age, when they were in the camps, it was a completely different experience. For some, it felt like summer camp. To others, it was like, you know, it was a very traumatic experience.
Uh-huh.
So when you look back on that, what kind of feelings does it bring back for you? Especially since you had such an unusual situation with.
Yeah, I feel that a lot of the families that were in camp, especially the mothers, they probably had a real good vacation. Because, you know.
Yeah, the ones that really had to work on the farm.
You know, they had to work. A lot of farmers' wife, you know, they had to go out and work almost as much as a regular people.
Yeah.
They had to cook the.
Besides keep the house.
Keep the house.
Yeah.
They had to help. Some families had employees board them.
Yeah,
you know.
So
when they had no time for any recreation.
Yeah.
So when they got into camp, they got all kind of time on their hands. So the women's had their women's club, and they had the. Flower arranging class, some singing class.
Sewing
yeah.
For a lot of the women, it was a vacation.
Yeah, very, very social. And,
yes,
and, uh-huh, yeah,
because before that, the ones that had to go out and help their dad, their husband on the farm, it was really hard.
Really hard, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Long days and very labor intensive.
Yeah, like I didn't have to.
Yeah. So that kind of gives all that kind of a different tint to thinking back to the camp experience for some.
Especially the young kids. But he wasn't little kids. They had so much to do.
Uh-huh.
They ran all over the place. And
when we first went to camp, it was really funny because, you know, the younger kids, they don't understand. So then here they're playing games and say, oh, the Japs are coming. The Japs.
that was
really funny.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
They didn't know, you know.
Yeah, they just didn't have the idea.
I'm gonna need to make another tape change here.
Okay, we'll be wrapping it up pretty quick. Talk to you.
Nice to meet my car. I'll be right back.
Yeah, it was really funny to hear that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they don't realize they're Japanese, you know.
Yeah.
Japs are coming. So funny.
How old were you while you were in there? Or when did it
mean? I was about 19 when I went in.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you were pretty, I mean, it was obviously a very real thing for you to be
intern.
Yeah.
Well, I was, I had a younger sister, you know, so, and my dad, and just my dad, because I lost my mother, and so I had to look after them, you know. So what I did was I went to, from camp, I went to Chicago, because we all had to get out of camp, you know,
yeah.
You were compelled to, so I went to Chicago and worked. Then I worked during the day and went to school at night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, then I went through beauty college.
Uh-huh.
And start working in a beauty shop after I got my license.
Oh, wow. That's cool. And then you came back out to out here to visit?
Yeah, and then I met him.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that?
He didn't want to know your story and my story.
I kind of think it was arranged. I think my girlfriend wanted me to meet him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a
pre-plan. Well, thing. I came to meet another girlfriend that I had already met in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And she lived here in Arroyo Grande.
Mm-hmm.
So when I went to visit my friend in Morro Bay, from childhood friend, and so she says, oh, you know, this girlfriend lived in Arroyo Grande. So I came to Arroyo Grande, and he purposely came to visit that friend. Just to look me over. funny.
Turned out lucky for her.
He conceded.
Yeah.
We were both 30, pretty old, though.
32.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And I
got married.
29 now.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't realize that. That's interesting. So
we were old.
So that's something that comes to mind. The first thing that comes to mind when you say that is, did you feel a lot of pressure to
marry him?
Get, you know, marry and settle and. Was that kind of
I was in no hurry.
So that was something where...
I think she was in a hurry.
No, because I was kind of taking care of my younger sister,
uh-huh.
although she got married before I did, so it was kind of a relief to me because I didn't have to look after her anymore, and then I still had my dad till he passed away.
Uh-huh. So is that kind of... You just wait until, you know, things kind of fell together...
And then I to this day I wonder how I did it, because I didn't hardly have any money to go to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Barely got to Chicago and found an apartment. Had to get a job
away.
Huh?
They gave you a fare to go to go out of camp.
Oh, that's right, to relocate. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But
it wasn't, you definitely had to make sure that you provided for yourself once you got out there. I mean, it wasn't like you were set.
Yeah, so even to this day, I wonder how I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know where to go, but we found my girlfriend and I found this apartment and we stayed there. Yeah.
So did you leave your family Did you separate from your family after the camp to go to Chicago, or did they come?
Well, I only had my dad and my sister. Uh-huh. I never had a mother for a long time.
Uh-huh.
And so I evacuated first to get my sister and my father out of the... Well, so they'd have a place to come.
Oh, okay. So you set up camp before, yes, uh-huh, before they left. Oh, okay.
I don't know how I did it, but
let's,
yeah, because then, for the part, we only got what, $26 a month,
oh,
or something. You know, depending on what kind of work you did.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you had a higher job, you got maybe a little more. But it was like $26 and $24 a month we got.
Where?
Wow.
In camp.
No, camp. We only got.
Yeah.
$16 and $19 was.
Was it?
$19 was a doctor's. Professionals.
Pay?
Yeah.
Well, everything else, meal and everything was free, so. You know.
Yeah, so.
That was your.
Oh, we got fed a lot of 16. Neck bones. I remember. And a lot of peanut butter.
A lot of peanut butter. Really? That's one thing that I've never really heard much about is that. I've actually heard conflicting stories that, you know, it wasn't really that bad, but never really specifics about.
Of the food we ate in camp.
Yeah. Uh huh.
I know
peanut
I
butter and apple.
Neck bone and apple butter. We got a lot of apple butter.
Interesting. That's interesting.
And, you know.
Orange. No, what is it?
I don't know what you got in your camp. He was in Gila,
mm-hmm,
and I was in Poston.
Yeah.
In same state, you know, in Arizona.
Yeah.
Because there were 10 camps.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now that's also something is how did you guys deal with the change in climate that
well, like for me it was no different because I was in a hot country and I went to a hot country in Arizona.
Uh-huh.
But for him I don't
know. You get accustomed to it.
Yeah. You grow used to it. Yeah. Long enough.
You formed a baseball team, huh, when you got to camp?
Yeah.
Baseball fanatic.
Yeah. Did you guys build your own diamond?
Yeah, they built the regular one nice complex and,
mm-hmm,
and one end of the camp. And there was one whole block that was empty, you know. So I lived on that end, so I helped build that and put the backstop up and everything.
Yeah.
But we played most of there was practice. We played a game from one. We lived on one this end of the camp, and it was catacorning on the opposite end. I finally got tired of walking, so I bought myself a little bicycle. And,
and so you get over there and play easy enough.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Not only play that, I did a lot of umpiring too.
Wow. So you kept yourself involved.
Yeah.
Did you have a movie once a week?
Yeah, the movie, but I never did go to the movie.
Yeah,
they didn't have any girlfriend
in certain
to take.
Blocks would bring a, they would bring a movie and show us the movies. I can't remember what they were, but and then you had to take your own chair, you know.
Oh, yeah. So it was some assembly required.
Yeah.
I never did go to the movie.
I did, I guess, because it was kind of in my block.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think there were 60 blocks in our camp or something.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so they were obviously very large. In order to, how's
mm-hmm, like, well, I was in a camp where they had 1, 2, and 3 different sections of camps.
Oh, okay.
So many miles apart. I forgot how many miles apart it was. 1 or 1 mile apart, can't remember.
Wow.
Out in the desert.
Oof.
I was used to the desert, so it wasn't hard for me, but for some people that came from the city,
uh-huh,
and then to live in this desert, it was hard.
Yeah, I bet. Uh-huh. And especially being just kind of thrown right into that.
Right, uh-huh. I felt so sorry for them.
Uh-huh.
Because yeah, I was used to the heat and all that. But, yeah. And then in my block, there was a man that caught rattlesnakes and ate rattlesnakes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because there's a lot of snakes out in the desert.
I guess it's a way to get a little bit something besides what they're giving you.
Yeah, and then our camp, his camp was, we were near the Colorado River. Mm-hmm. Yeah, people, I think some people walked 8 miles and went to the river to fish. And
oh, wow. So were they, were you able to leave fairly often and free to go?
No, we weren't. Not at the beginning. We couldn't leave camp.
Uh-huh. And then did you, did it kind of become more and more lax towards the longer
well,
you
the
were
person
in?
We were compelled to.
To leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So, well, I have one kind of fun question to ask you, Mr. Kane, is actually my roommate wanted to know. He said, ask him who his favorite baseball player was.
Who's
your favorite baseball player?
My favorite baseball player? Well, first was, when you're a kid, you know, you talk about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Yankee was my favorite team.
Uh-huh.
Then when Jackie Robinson was the first player to go get into Major League,
uh-huh,
Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah.
He was one of my favorite.
Uh-huh.
Joe DiMaggio. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I was a Yankee fan when I was...
Tell us how old he is.
What?
As it shows how old you are.
Then when the Dodgers and Giants moved West Coast,
mm-hmm,
Brooklyn Dodgers was my favorite over there when they came over this way. San Francisco Giants is my favorite team. Willie Mays.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now you're a Giants fan now?
Giants fan.
Yep. That's
Giants. Giants and that Lincecum or something, that pitcher.
Uh-huh.
Oh, gee.
Yeah, he's something else. Yeah.
Never heard of him until this year. And
yeah, he just got the
MVP,
Gold Club. He's something else.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, I think we're able to get a lot of good stuff today. And so I just wanted to thank you guys for participating on behalf of the Cal Poly South County Tournament Oral Histories. So
we'll catch all these other fellows.
Yeah, I'm
like
sure.
Doi family,
uh-huh,
like Ben Doi. Yeah, we play golf, try to play golf once a week, but we're all 80 and over. You know.
So good.
A couple of us are 90s.
Uh huh.
You don't have that in tape, do you?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not. This doesn't concern you, so. Turn them off.
Get you guys, as long as you guys are still able to get out there,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's the purpose of the thing, is just to get out there and swing your club
around. Swing your club around a little bit if you can,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Funny thing is, when you go out, I go out there and once in a while I have a pretty good day, which I consider is a pretty good day, you know.
Uh-huh.
I come home and she doesn't say anything to me, you see. I'm waiting for her to ask me how I did. She won't say, don't say anything.
I ask him when he has a bad game.
When I have a lousy game, she asked me, how did you do today? How come you asked me that today?
What about the other day?
Yeah.
She's got plenty. He knows.
She knows.
Well, just look at me and he could tell.
keep you on with your feet on the ground. You know, out of the clouds.
I wanted to learn to play golf too, but and I couldn't, because I lived with his mother. So.
Oh, okay, yeah. So.
Well, she had to raise four kids. So
yeah. Yeah. That's a feat unto itself. Yeah, but I'm sure that this will not be the last time that you'll be hearing from us, just to, because I just think it's really interesting. So, that you.